It's officially 2026, and my New Year's resolution is to prioritize high-quality pieces in my wardrobe. Thanks to Quince, I can already check that off my list. I'm already planning outfits around my new cotton Oxford shirt. It's such a classic, timeless piece that I know I'll be rewearing all year. Need more than just a wardrobe update? Quince has tons of options for the home as well. Maya has had the same dinnerware since college and has finally decided it's time for a refresh, starting with a gorgeous set of ceramic cake plates. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Don't wait. Go to quince.com/rehash for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/rehash to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rehash.
Hey guys, before we start the episode, I just wanted to pop in here and apologize for this sort of not so great audio quality. We didn't realize until partway through recording that there was an issue with our mics. We're still kind of learning how to record remotely, and there are some hiccups that come along the way, but we hope you enjoyed the episode anyways.
Happy New Year,
you guys. Happy New Year. Wow. We just recorded this today that you're listening to this, and we've had the best December ever. And 2024 ended on a really positive note. And 2025 is going to start really good, too. Everything's turned around. They solved climate change. And Donald Trump hurt his leg. And now he's resigned from office.
That was a really gentle approach to Donald Trump. Love.
I know. I just don't want to be accused of something because this goes on the internet. But yeah. Transparency, it's December 1st that we record this, but Maya, if we were to flash forward 30 days, what are your New Year's resolutions?
If not now, then when, am I right? Like, better late than never.
Oh, or question, what were your New Year's resolutions for this year, and do you feel like you accomplished them? I had two.
Hannah's was to be more of a bitch.
And to read more. I didn't read more. I read a couple books.
Yeah, what did you read?
I finally read The Great Gatsby. It slapped. But I was really slow with it. I read The Guest by Emma Klein. That was really good. I'm sure I read other things, but like I didn't read as much as I intended to. But I still aspire to be more literary. And I do think I was more of a bitch this year. I think that I...
Absolutely. I was a fucking bitch.
Yeah, and now Maya has to go to therapy. Sorry.
I think you successfully did both of those things, and I'm really proud of you. Those were distinct
Thank
resolutions.
You. I didn't read more. The Great Gatsby is a really short book.
You're partway through The Secret History, and that's it.
Oh my god, I know. I really, when will I finish that book?
I don't know, you're on vacation and you have a lot of time.
I know, but I'm always doing something. I have very little
time. You were just in Ireland alone for like a month.
No, I was with my family.
Okay, but you had like weeks alone. I'm not read shaming you. I'm not
You're bullying me. We get it. You were in the gifted program growing up. You're better than everybody.
Oh my god, don't out me like that.
So what were your resolutions, Miss Perfect?
To be less of a bitch. I think that was one of my resolutions. Did I succeed? Probably not.
I think yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Is this coming from anything specific, or are you just being nice to
me? No, I really do think that...
Which this is not you being very bitchy.
No, I know. I'm being real this time. I actually think... And not that Maya was like this monster of a person, but I feel like you've just been... I don't know. I feel like you... are more like fuzzy. You're like a little more warm and fuzzy.
Oh my god, that really speaks to how down bad I was the past couple years, I think.
I think that like last year maybe was you just kind of were peaking in your bitchiness, but like not in a bad way. This sounds really mean. Like
for me.
This sounds like I'm saying really mean things about my friend. Can we scratch this from the record?
I don't think you're being mean at all. I think this is very accurate. And yeah, last year was a really bad year for me. This year was also pretty rough, but not as bad.
But I also need to, like, you're not a bitch. To quote Charlie XCX, like, I think that you can be bitchy, but you're not like a bitch. That wow, viral sound. Good. Thank
I'm
you.
A little misanthropic, I would say, and a little bit cranky. So I guess, I don't know, but I'm nice to people.
Well, you know, I know what the thing is that you're also like weirdly very like sentimental about things. You have a certain whimsy. You know what I'll say? I think that you've made me a little more misanthropic, but like for the better. And maybe I've made you a little less for the better.
Wow, that's beautiful. I mean, I've always been a sentimental person, and I don't know about
no, can't I take credit for you?
I'll take it. And I don't want to take credit for you being more misanthropic. I think you're less of a pushover, which I think...
But that's what I mean. I think I just realized... I think I had like slightly naive expectations of the world. Like I just expected people to meet me at my level, and maybe my level was a little bit naive. Yeah.
I think that's beautiful. Yeah. I think I may have bullied Hannah into being less.
That's okay. No. And now we're shaping this.
It was kind of tough love.
You did not bully me. Let's scratch that.
I think I like tough loved you into not letting people walk all over you, which I think you did. And I think you're such a slay girl. Hannah's arc over the past few years has just been magnificent to watch. And I think
Maya thinks she's a bitch and then she says stuff like that. And Maya loves me so much. It's crazy. And I love her back. I wasn't even being sarcastic.
No, I just love that we treated this intro like couples therapy.
Yeah, also like, do you guys give a shit?
Girls, tell us something you love about each other. That was our therapist to me and you just now. What's something you love about Hannah? Anyway.
Oh my god, okay. Therapy actually leads us into our topic. But first of all, I'm Hannah.
And I'm Aya.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the internet phenomena that strike a nerve in our culture, only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. This season is about internet subcultures. The stories of how they arrived, thrived, and sometimes died. If you like our show and want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have bonus episodes, weekly minisodes, and early access to our regular programming. If you don't want to join the Patreon, feel free to rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, because that helps us out a lot. True crime is a loaded and deeply divisive subject. Some find it offensive. I think others call it their guilty pleasure. But I think what we learned in the late 2010s is that a surprising number of people not only love true crime, but like do so proudly. There are many kind of subsects of true crime fanatics, especially on the internet. You know, you have like serial killer fangirls on Tumblr, and then you have online sleuths who are trying to solve murders on TikTok and Reddit. And I think that those would be really interesting subjects to potentially cover in the future. So we're not going to speak too much about them today. But what I want to talk about is true crime podcasts, specifically the massively popular one, My Favorite Murder, and their fans who call themselves murderinos. There are murderinos of all ages and genders, but a very large portion of them seem to be millennial and Gen X women. And what I've gotten from looking more into the show and the fan base, and also admittedly from being a previous listener of the show, is that a lot of these women have managed to find some kind of therapeutic benefit from not only true crime as a genre, but specifically from being a part of this specific fandom or subculture. So before we kind of get deeper into that, I just want to talk a bit more generally about women in true crime, because I'd say at this point, it's pretty well known that women are like the predominant consumers of true crime. And like, I think publicly are like more associated with true crime. You've seen that, right? Like you'd agree.
Yeah, totally. I think that's a pretty, I wouldn't say it's common knowledge, but for those who have been interested in the true crime phenomenon, I think.
In my mind, there's this sort of like stereotypical image of almost a girl, like a Christian girl, autumn girl, who's like also going and watching, you know, some kind of Netflix true crime documentary. It's become, I just think that, you know, true crime podcasts and like miniseries and all of that have become almost water cooler moments. Like they're things that you talk about and whatever is like the case of the moment. Like if you brought up JonBenet Ramsey to a group of women, I think they'd all come at you with their theories because they've consumed something about it. Or like Gypsy Rose Blanchard, for example.
Netflix came out with another
I know
JonBenet Netflix documentary. There was one day a few, like a couple weeks ago, I was with a friend and I like made a JonBenet joke, which I'm sorry. I've apologized for it in my head, but I made a JonBenet joke and then we were like talking about JonBenet. And then I was watching Broad City that night and it's the episode where she has like a JonBenet doll or something. And then I opened Netflix later that night and JonBenet Ramsey, like the new documentary, there's already fucking like six on there. The new one popped up and I was like, this is crazy.
We're never going to know. It was probably someone in the family, but we're never going
to
know.
Definitely her brother, not to be speculative, I know. But like, come on.
I know. I'm like, guys, it's like, come on. It's don't talk about it. It's disrespectful. But I'm like, also, come on, guys. It's obviously the brother. Why do we keep talking about these other theories?
That case is such a good example of like people are so much more willing to buy like an insane, sensational story rather than something that's actually mundane and just quite sad. Like the way she died is not sensational. It's just sad. And people just would way rather buy into the crazy story, which I find fascinating. Like they're not willing to admit that like regular human beings are capable of killing others. And I think that that's something we need to reckon with.
Well, yeah. And in that one specifically, people also love to bring up all these kind of weird details about the family as if that like people, I don't know. It's just like the weird things that people will also bring up like retroactively is sinister proof. And I have to clear with my mom if I'm allowed to mention this, but like people always talk about how Patsy Ramsey dyed JonBenet's hair blonde and she was naturally a brunette. But I always laugh because my mom's mom did that to her because she had five daughters and wanted a blonde one. It was a different time, but also so weird. But also like I think doesn't really mean that my grandmother would be complicit in any kind of like weird murder plot.
People love to take the pageantry stuff and mix it with strange like Kabbalah theories. And it's just like, oh man, come on guys. Like we can talk about the strangeness of JonBenet. We can talk about this forever. Maybe we're becoming.
Yeah. Okay. But see, look at us doing it. And it's because I have watched probably multiple JonBenet documentaries. I have listened to stuff. I have like read into it because I mean, I'm just going to say here, like, I am one of these women that used to consume a lot of true crime. And I'll be talking about it a bit more throughout the episode. But I know a lot about a lot of cases. I've forgotten some details over time.
Well,
but
I had my true crime phase as well.
And so there's an often cited study from the journal Social Psychology and Personality Science, which found that 70% of Amazon reviews under the top 25 most popular true crime books were penned by women. And this was before true crime like had its big boom later in the 2010s. But even back then, I think when people were mostly like just reading true crime novels, it's mostly been women. And so I guess, yeah, if you want to talk a bit about like your personal relationship with true crime, like how you got into it, how much of it you were consuming, this would be a great time.
I've always been pretty like easily affected by media about like femicide, especially. Like I think it really deeply upsets me. Like my teacher assigned us The Lovely Bones in grade 8, and I remember that being kind of like the first introduction. Obviously in the 2000s we really grew up with the Stranger Danger era. We've talked about her before, but there was a girl in our area when we were kids who was kidnapped and murdered horrifically, and I think that really was like a rude awakening for a lot of people in Toronto and like a lot of little girls about our places in society, essentially. And I think reading The Lovely Bones was an extremely upsetting experience for me. Like, it's just something that's like, it's like when you read something that's too close to home and you're like, that's not, this isn't, like, I don't know. I actually was always really negatively affected by it because I was like, this is not something I want to think about because it is a reality. Like, it's something that could happen to me and, like, I am the target. But then in like 2019, I think I was kind of going through it and I started listening to a lot of true crime podcasts. I think you actually introduced me to one of them. I can't remember the name.
Or was it Case File? Case maybe, File. Yeah, the Australian one.
Yeah, I was listening to ones about, you know, Elisa Lam, like that really fucked up story, and which yeah. I don't really get into because it upsets me. But
And also that's something that once you start talking about it, rabbit hole, like you will just...
Yeah, I can't even think about it. Spiral. I started listening to like music true crime stuff too. Like I was like listening to this podcast about this Norwegian death metal band, and that really upset me. And I don't know, but it's like I was listening to it, and I was listening to it all the time, and it was really serotonin boosting content. Not in the sense that it made me happy, but that it was like you're getting like not serotonin, but like dopamine rushes, kind of these sensational, kind of like morbid stories. I think humans are really predisposed towards morbidity, and I don't know. I guess fascinating to think about why we are. But looking back on that period, I'm like, I was really not doing well. I feel like my mental state 100% of the time was pretty down. And I think it also gave me a really negative worldview. It's like when you tune into local news and you're like, oh, I don't know if I needed to know about every stabbing in my area. You know what I mean? It's like, I could know about the dangers that are around me, but like, it amplifies your knowledge in a way that actually kind of like negatively affects your worldview. So I think I had a little bit more of a different kind of like the adverse reaction to it, where I think a lot of women actually feel comforted by it, which I know
yeah.
you do. So yeah, that was my relationship to it. And I just stopped listening to it because I was like, this is just not healthy for me.
Well, I was going to ask you, do you have any theories as to what might draw women specifically to the genre of true crime?
Well, yeah, I think, and you and I have talked about this a lot, but in the same way, like so many people are drawn to horror because it feels like a controlled space within which they can consume these more terrifying like extremes of human behavior and like reality. I think the same with true crime, like it's a controlled way to engage with dangerous realities in a way that can kind of be therapeutic, or I don't want to say therapeutic because I don't want to give it any scientific backing, but I think a little bit cathartic for women to be able to like, you know, keep this thing within their AirPods, you know, like it doesn't leave that. And I think that in some ways has merits.
I think that is definitely a key element, and we'll be kind of talking a bit more about that later in the episode. And then this study that I cited earlier, they kind of hypothesized their own reasons that they were trying to get to the bottom of with like women in true crime. They suggested that one, survival and self-defense tactics, they might be listening or consuming to sort of try and know what not to do in a situation. And then there's like understanding the psychology of predators and wanting to get inside the head of people who would do this type of thing. And then also weirdly like identification with the victims who tend to be women. For some reason, like women are drawn to stories about other women being hurt. And I will say, like, I feel like I definitely, majority of the true crime I consumed did pertain to other women.
And that is so often, like, I think a lot of sensational murders do, unfortunately, yeah. women tend to be the targets of them. Like, the more juicy stories.
Yeah. Well, because the interesting thing, I think, people often try to point to, like, well, women consume more true crime because surely women are the victims of murder more often. And, of course, statistically, it's actually men. But when mm-hmm. we do get down to perhaps the stories of interest that pique interest, the ones that have the kind of gritty details, you know, and especially something like serial killers or the ones that are more salacious, I think maybe statistically it's more women, but also like maybe we are just more comfortable or more like used to the idea of a victim looking like a certain type of person, which is a woman who is usually white. And so those are the stories that we yeah. also like are tend to be drawn to and tend to retell.
Those are the ones that have gotten most coverage. I also think there's a kind of a psychosexual element to femicide that I think murders of men less so tend to have that element that I think maybe adds to the kind of like voyeurism of listening to stories about femicide in a way that kind of changes the yeah. dynamic of the listener, the viewer, to the story. So I don't know.
It is interesting, and it's a kind of a weird thing to self-reflect on. Why am I like, a story about a man killing a man? Boring. I need a strong female lead to identify with.
Yeah, and there's also something about, like, the female body. Like, there's so much attention to, like, what happens to the female body. And, like, so much attention to place. I'm like, oh, and then she was naked. Like, it's very morbid and voyeuristic in a way that feels, like, kind of perverse. But, like, yeah, people are just inherently drawn to it.
Yeah, no. I mean, so, like, similarly to you, I think when I first got into true crime, I think a lot of understanding why I was, like, so fascinated by this also went back to growing up very close proximity to a really horrible crime that happened almost in my neighborhood. Not gonna go into detail, but just like what had happened to this girl was something that we talked about on the playground. You'd pass posters. It changed our relationship with the world as kids because suddenly I think there was a stronger emphasis on like stranger danger. Obviously that already existed as a result of like the 90s happening. But I think it just, yeah, from a very young age, like made me very scared of the world and of what was lurking in the shadows. And
reasonably so. Like the proximity was insane. Like both of us grew up in the West End. That's where it happened. Like I grew up on the river that they found her. And it changes your relationship to space. Yeah, and you don't think of yourself as prey when you're a baby. It's like coming into your gender, basically, and being like, oh, and now I occupy this gender.
But then at the same time, like, we'd be on the playground and we'd be exchanging theories based off of nothing or tidbits of information you heard from adults. And it's like the early stages of whatever this is now, where you're like,
of course.
Guessing.
So many kids, like, you know how kids lie a lot? Like, there's so many kids in my school who are like, she was actually my best friend. And it's like, we didn't actually live as close to like her as you guys did. Like, I think Hannah had much more proximity to it, but it's like the kids at my school were all like, yeah, that was my best friend. And it's like, it's just something that kids do, but then it is kind of like feeding into this like primal.
No, for thing, sure.
Like, wanting to be proximal to death and wanting to be proximal to
stories.
Yeah. Stories.
Yeah, of course. And then like the weird, I think maybe desensitization that happens in our brains. And I think that as I got older, like I was scared of everything growing up. And I think when I started first listening to true crime, it was sort of because I had this fascination with criminal law. And it started from a place of like hearing more about cases through that lens and through learning about them in law class and learning about the trial aspects of things, miscarriages of justice. But then I started just like listening to true crime stories more generally. And then it just became this thing. And when I started listening to true crime like you, I was in a really bad place in my life. And I also found this sort of comfort in it because I think part of it is like when you get into podcasts, you kind of grow attachments to the people that you're listening to the voices, even if you're not even fully paying attention to the story, maybe. But also I think as someone who was so afraid of everything at all times, and in some ways, like because of things that I knew had happened when I was a kid, I think I kind of almost felt like it was a form of exposure therapy to like hear about all the terrible things that can happen and then weirdly feel less afraid of the fact that they could happen. Because Maya and I sort of have opposite rationalities when it comes to some of this stuff, where for me, I'm like, well, the reason I'm hearing about this story is because it was so sensational and it was so out of the ordinary that it's made its way into like public consciousness. It's become a news story.
Hannah's a statistics queen with criminology. She loves to be like, well, actually, statistically, this is very unlikely.
But it has brought me like such a sense of comfort. But I don't think that that's necessarily the impact that these stories have on a lot of people. I think a lot of women listening are hearing these things and becoming more afraid of what could happen to them, trying to become more vigilant about avoiding things that like statistically are still like highly improbable, but like once it's entered your mind, it's like an intrusive thought too.
Well, for me, it's also like statistically it's improbable, but the marginal statistic of that happening to me is like the worst possible thing that can happen to you. So you know what I mean? It's like, it's such a horrible thing to have happen to you that you're like, I would never want that to happen. So even your awareness of it, like just the extremes of where humans are willing to go, it's like, that is upsetting in itself, you know what I mean?
Well, of course. Also, if you're walking,
like, I can know it's statistically improbable, but still be like, yeah, but I don't want that to happen regardless, you know?
No, of course. It's like if you're walking down the street at night and you have an intrusive thought, you're like, oh, what if something bad happens in this moment? Suddenly, of course, you're going to be alert. You're going to be afraid. And it's kind of hard to avoid. And then as a woman, it's like you're constantly told that you should be afraid of things, that you are a victim and that you will be a victim of things. So you also internalize that as well. And then there's the fact that these things do also happen. And like, we do live in a culture that is like violent towards women in many ways, even if it's not always in the kind of gratuitous, like sensationalized way that makes the news. And women get murdered all the time, but often in less sexy ways, let's say. Yeah. But I think that these, yeah, of course, these narratives, when we hear about murder only through the lens of those types of scenarios, gives us a warped view of what we should be afraid of, when really we should be afraid of like the men in our lives more than anything.
I know that's right.
But I think considering all the different ways that like women are interested in true crime, I think it's one thing to just be a fan of certain podcasts or to have fascinations with certain cases versus like being a fanatic or being a part of what is in many ways like an internet subculture around the subject matter. Clearly there are many possible reasons why women or like anyone might be interested in true crime, but I want to now talk about my favorite murder and what it is about this show in particular that has elevated listeners from being just interested or fascinated into being like outright fanatics and even calling themselves murderinos. So I, like many people, began listening to podcasts after being recommended Serial. Serial, of course, was a wildly popular podcast hosted by journalist Sarah Koenig. Its first season was released in 2014, and it attempts to further investigate the 1999 murder of Haemin Lee and whether or not her ex-boyfriend Adnan Syed had been wrongfully convicted for her murder. The show was wildly popular and is often credited with not only starting the true crime podcast boom, but also like introducing podcasts to people in general. You listened to Serial, Maia?
Yeah, it was the first podcast I listened to.
Over the years, Koenig and Serial have come under a lot of criticism for a number of reasons. I'm sure have your own observations, but you've also heard some of the discourse.
Yeah. The criticism of Serial, generally the thrust of it, is just that Sarah Koenig is approaching it from this like journalistic POV, but also does a lot of general speculating about Adnan and kind of introducing like unhelpful questions that are like, was he actually a psycho? Was he not? And it's also just very criticized for garnering this like fandom or like really intense horde of armchair investigators into a case. And it's like, this girl was a real person. She has a real family. They were satisfied with the decision of Adnan going to prison. Of course, he actually was exonerated recently. But it's like to have people speculating about a very real thing, like life-altering tragedy that happened to your family, must have been extremely re-traumatizing for the family. And Serial kind of ignores a lot of that in service of this journalistic approach that isn't actually that journalistic. And so I think that's kind of the main criticism of it.
Yeah, like she was accused, I think, by some of being too biased towards Adnan, but also kind of omitting pieces of information that helped his case because it made the story also be presented more ambiguous than it was. Like,
well, there was some it's entertainment. Like, she's selling a narrative regardless of how journalistic it's meant to be.
Yeah, like, yes, it's a true crime case, but it also just kind of feels like a meditation on what the truth is and memory, and feels a bit more like the kinds of human interests, like soft journalism pieces that usually come out of This American Life, who are the people behind Serial. Mm-hmm. So it took this story about like two teenagers of color and their families in this legal system that like didn't really leave anyone fully satisfied, and then package it up for like tote bag wearing NPR listener types. Mm-hmm. And I think it kind of, I don't know, occupied a weird place. But that being said, I listened to all of it and consumed it and loved it. And I think a lot of people did.
Yeah, it feels like an extension of, you know, America's Most Wanted, where it's like, it's just repackaging something very real and making it entertainment. It's just that America's Most Wanted is like kind of a trashy show, and Serial is very highbrow in a way that it allowed people to feel like they were very intelligent for listening to it. I gobbled it right up. I felt very smart because I was like, I'm listening to a podcast. But of course, this is someone's life and death, and also Adnan's life. Like, this is his life. And the podcast did very much benefit him, and that's great depending on where you're looking at it from. But at the same time, yeah, it's like, I think a lot is owed to the podcast. It's a difficult piece of media because it's like a lot is owed to it, but then also it has so many problems, and it's tough.
And I think it sort of sets up this weird kind of like power dynamic between podcasts and their subjects, where sometimes podcasts or documentaries are credited with bringing more attention to cases that have either been forgotten or like never got that attention in the first place, which can like spark more motivation to relook at things or to give certain aspects like more attention. But then it also does encourage, like you said, a lot of armchair detectives, a lot of online sleuths. And sometimes simultaneously, like cold case divisions will be investigating a case at the same time that it becomes subject of a podcast. So we don't really know what to credit to what. And I don't think that's the case in Serial. I think that they were really happy to like keep Adnan in jail forever. And I do think that this did allow for that to be changed. But I don't know, it's just with other cases, it's a bit more like ambiguous. And I think we put too much emphasis on like the power of these podcasts to make things happen.
And Serial is like the highest brow you can get. I feel like after Serial, if you go a bit further, it just gets a lot worse from there.
That brings us to my favorite murder.
Sounds like you're saying that it's your favorite murder. Winning. There's no winning with that podcast title.
And that's sort of the first thing that struck me about My Favorite Murder when I came across it on iTunes after, you know, devouring Serial. And I thought that it sounded really distasteful and crass, but it was always at the top of the true crime charts. So I was like, sure, I will listen to this. And when I first started listening, I was kind of like icked out by the comedic tone of the show. Actually, let me just explain what My Favorite Murder is first. So My Favorite Murder is a true crime comedy podcast, which was started by Karen Kilgariff and Georgia Hardstark in 2016 after they met at a party and learned they had a shared interest in true crime. Karen is a stand-up comedian and a comedy writer, and Georgia was like a cooking channel host when they met. And they're basically like, we were at this party and one of us had witnessed like a really gruesome car accident or something, and everyone, or like something to do with the car accident, and everyone else seemed kind of weirded out by the fact that they wanted to like go into detail about it, but then the other one was like, oh, that's so interesting, tell me more. And then they realized that they both had like grown up being obsessed with like serial killers and gruesome stories, and it kind of sprung from there. They were just looking for like a project to do together, and the show blew up really quickly. Like, I started listening pretty early on in its run, and it was already like wildly popular. We have a podcast. We've seen how our audience grows over the years, but like theirs was kind of like a skyrocket situation. But the show that they put together, I think, kind of takes the whole journalistic debate about the ethics of true crime and basically takes a giant like poo-poo on it. So their format is not that different from our own. The hosts will kind of yap about unrelated things up top, and then they'll take turns telling each other stories while the other person reacts. Their conversation is casual. There's a lot of segues. They tell a lot of jokes, and there's a kind of just casual feeling to it, like two besties chatting on the couch.
We invented that.
I know. Actually, I thought that this was the first podcast.
You mean to tell me that we are not the first of our kind?
You mean Serial didn't get its inspiration from us?
From us?
Obviously, like, this format worked so slay and is so awesome on this show, but can you think of why it might not translate as gracefully to the subject of true crime?
Well, yeah, your subject is like real people losing their lives in really violent, painful ways too young. And you're like, that's funny. Like, what a strange combination. And it's like, it'd be one thing if it's like a some sort of like macabre comedy show where everything's like invented and fantastical, but this is like actually real people with families. Again, similar to the Haman Lee situation. Like, they're real victims of these crimes, still living because the families are victims as well. But yeah, kind of making it just silly banter. Like, imagine dying. Imagine getting like axe murdered only to find out in the afterlife that you're the subject of some like comedy podcast. Like, damn.
And you know, the show isn't laughing at the victims.
No,
it's not laughing at the events. I think they take a generally sympathetic approach to the actual events of the crime. Sometimes they'll opt not to go into too much detail because they find it undignifying to talk about.
Something that's like an event that is so huge that it killed you, ruined your entire family's life, being treated as like another bit of content within an episode that also has like tangents about someone cooking breakfast that morning is like, yeah, this is like the singular event in your life, and this is just like an appendage on someone else's, and they're making money off of that, you know? Like,
yeah.
that's what I'm saying. Yeah, they're not making fun of the murders, but they're, you know, it is kind of like diminutive
for sure. And I think on top of that, with some of the other shows that like we've both consumed, there's like clear evidence of dedicated time and research that goes into telling the stories. And at least early on in the show, like when My Favorite Murder blew up, they were admittedly basically just copy pasting Wikipedia articles. They got a lot of flack actually from Canadian listeners early on because they covered Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka and did such a bad job on it that they ended up redoing it at their Toronto live show because they got the details and like the facts are wrong. And it's like, if there's a case like Canadians know about, it's that one. And like,
yeah,
they
yeah,
will.
That's the case.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to be the people who are covering someone's insane, like this is an insane event in someone's life, and then not even just having like basic facts, right? Like, I get facts wrong all the time, but I feel like if it's such a serious subject, you think you'd
well, no
grace, care?
And I think their approach for it and sort of the kind of justification that they give and the sort of cover up is that the show itself has a sort of like DIY tone. It's just two girls talking. They record it themselves from their couch. They're like, we're not experts. We're just people who are interested in it. And it's supposed to feel almost like, if you were like, oh my God, did you see this show about this case? Like, let's unpack it together.
Like a water cooler.
Into microphones. And they have like a segment on the show called Corrections Corner where they'll go back and basically everything that fans have written in that like, you got this wrong. They'll admittedly be like, okay, whoops, we screwed up on that. I think over time they've become more diligent with their research. I think they have researchers hired now, but
the amazing thing about research is that you can indeed DIY.
That's what we do here, baby.
I mean, again, I literally have you as a researcher on my YouTube channel, but I also do the research too. Because
actually, guys, I am Brie Deschanel.
Hannah is actually really small and she lives inside my brain and operates it with controls.
Pay no attention to the Hannah behind the curtains. Like,
I don't know.
The Wizard of Oz, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
Oh, wicked. Wicked show.
Defying gravity. But like the general vibe of the show is supposed to be a bit like, we're former punky kind of quirky girls. I imagine them kind of like Janine Garofalo characters who are into like cross stitching and stuff and like used to be Riot Girls, like that sort of vibe. So there's a bit of like a, yes, we're factually incorrect sometimes, but like, fuck you, nobody's perfect. Which, you know, we're two nerds who are obsessed with getting all our information right most of the time and know it all. So I think it's hard for me to picture having such a big platform and perhaps approaching it from that direction.
Here, I can't really. And this is not to say we get everything right. We get things wrong all the time, but, you know, we're trying.
No, we're perfect. We know everything. So, yeah, there's a lot of debate about the ethics of turning true crime into entertainment in general. But then the comedic nature of My Favorite Murder, or MFM, as its listeners refer to it, it does take all of that debate to the next level. I think when I first started listening to it, I thought it was like weird and kind of upsetting that they took this tone. But then like I was interested in the stories they were telling. And I think what happens with podcasts is like sometimes you just get attached to personalities or like the vibe of a show. And you're like, I'm kind of going to look the other way at things I don't agree with or things that give me pause because I'm just like, I'm here almost for like the mise-en-scene of hearing these two people talk.
I mean, all my friends who listen to Red Scare.
Yeah, well, exactly. And I don't know, I feel like in the grand scheme of things, My Favorite Murder is not as like damaging as Red Scare. I will say that.
Yeah.
But I'm here to make that case. But I, you know, I'm sure some of you are tuning out everything we're saying right now and you just want to hear our beautiful melodic voices and powerful, palpable chemistry.
Someone on Apple Podcasts said it sounds like we secretly hate each other, and we do.
I mean, we started this episode with calling each other bitches, so there you go. I think this internal conflict that I was feeling between having such like morbid interests and then, you know, wanting to feel like a nice and decent person has become sort of like a fundamental aspect to My Favorite Murder and its self-branding. And I think it's something that a lot of women who feel shame about listening to stories about horrible things happening to women really identified with. They show up in like large groups to their live shows, which all begin with the following speech that Karen gives. She says, "Georgia and I have been obsessed with true crime since we were little kids. So we love and follow and are obsessed with true crime and the stories about them. But then we also, personality-wise, we're just both two funny people who like to express ourselves through comedy and as a coping mechanism to get through this total piece of shit called life." And then tells people who have a problem with their approach that they can get the fuck out. And then everybody in the audience would like applause and cheer. And what do you think of this sort of justification of like, well, it makes us feel good. We're interested in this. This is how we cope. Deal with it.
You're not the ones being murdered. Like, you're not the, I mean, I don't want to speak too broadly because maybe I don't know them, but it's like, as far as I know, neither of them is like the family member of someone who's a victim of a violent crime and like violent murder. So it's like, okay, well, that's your coping mechanism, but like some people lost their family members and can never get them back, and like maybe they use humor to cope with it, but it's like, you're not them. Like, I don't know. Yeah, life is shitty, but these aren't your stories. These are other people's stories that you're taking and profiting off of. And it's like, well, okay, I guess you're making yourself feel better about someone else's murder, but like, you're not close to it. So it's easier for you to do that.
And I wonder what we attribute this kind of mentality that a lot of people have, which is, if something helps me with my mental health or like helps me cope with something, then it must be healthy or it must be okay, or like I'm entitled to whatever coping mechanisms I want. It's the kind of thinking that gets us into like positions where we're like, well, if I'm going through something, I'm allowed to be an asshole, or I'm allowed to kind of put my own well-being before a sense of like morality or like obligation to other people. And I don't know, I just see kind of strings of that in here.
Yeah, it's just a bit dismissive, I think.
So who are these murderinos that are showing up to these shows? And like, why do I think that they get their own subculture?
Yeah, why do they get their own subculture? What's my
why
subculture?
Why do they get to be your subculture? I think you, me, and Mooney have our own subculture called Beautiful Girls.
The Mooneyrinos?
Mooney is Maya's cat also.
Yeah, Mooney's ass was
for the non
for a while. She likes to stick her butt in other people's business.
I miss her. I miss her butt. From very early on in My Favorite Murder's existence, the podcast had a Facebook group where fans could congregate and like share true crime news and their own hometown murder stories with one another. And at first, the group was run by Karen in Georgia, but as it continued to grow, they had to start bringing in like volunteer moderators because the group was growing. It would eventually be more than 235,000 members in their official Facebook group. And that's just like the official one. There were tons of offshoot communities formed where fans could combine their murderino status with other shared interests. Like there was a Facebook group called Meowderinos for cat-loving murderinos, Crafterinos, people who craft and talk about true crime, Murderino Skincare Connection, Murderinos Cleaning and Getting Organized, Murderino Weddings, and this is just to name a few.
Oh my god, like Disney adult weddings. They're just like the morbid version of Disney adults.
Well, literally, they're like, you can either have like a really far side part and wear skinny jeans and be a Disney adult, or I don't know, like have micro bangs and combat boots and you're a murderino.
I love that you have a far side part. Like it's far away. It's in the
distance. I'm just assuming, right? I'm sorry. I need to lean away from stereotyping others. I'm sorry.
No, I'm just laughing at the phrase far side part. That's so funny. Like a deep side part?
Yeah.
So funny.
I don't know phrases. But like to me, this kind of shows how these listeners, these murderinos, they're not just fans. Like other aspects of their life are intersecting with being a murderino, which kind of suggests that the murderino part is like central to their identity. Do you agree with that? Do you think this sort of qualifies as subculture status?
Totally. I think that's what we're finding in most of the episodes is like, you know, with furries, it's like they have furry sex, but it's because they are furries. Or with emos, it's like, yeah, someone having an emo wedding. It's like, well, that's just who they are. They're emos. So yeah. This, I guess, in some ways would be no different, but I would liken it a bit more to Disney adults where it's like, yeah, but the entire central focus of the identity is something very strange and probably not super healthy, especially this one. Like, Disney adults, I'll even give a bit more leeway
here. Oh my god, really? We should rank the subcultures by like
how to offend everyone. No, I don't like hate Disney adults, you know, or I don't hate anyone. I don't hate anyone, but I'm critical of Disney adults to an extent, but I'm not like, oh, they're rude, like they're fucked. Like, I don't know. I think with murderinos, I'm like, get a grip. Get a grip.
Yeah. For some of them, they'll tell you that this is how they get their grip, and let me explain why.
Ah, hell yeah.
I think the thing that makes people not just obsessed with true crime, but like really obsessed with this specific show and this specific packaging of true crime is the fact that a major part of My Favorite Murder's appeal is that it is proudly for the mentally ill girlies. Both Karen and Georgia are recovered addicts. Karen was an alcoholic and Georgia had a meth addiction as a teenager. They speak about these aspects of their lives very freely on the podcast. They talk a lot about the breakthroughs that they've had with their therapist. They go to therapy together as podcast hosts, like, which I was lolling at because we kind of started this episode as if we were in our own form of therapy. But they talk a lot about like struggling with depression and anxiety, and I think somehow have like made that equally as big a part of their brand as a show as the true crime aspect of it. And I think, you know, like we talked about earlier, there's always been this argument that learning about and discussing true crime can help alleviate anxiety, which I would argue like it sort of did for me, at least with that kind of anxiety. But then obviously there's the other side of the coin that it sort of perpetuates those anxieties, like you were saying for yourself, in which I think that a lot of the show can sometimes say that they're trying to do the latter but end up doing the former, because while they're talking about cases, they'll sort of put in their own sort of advice or takes on like what you should or shouldn't do in these situations, or not like they're like weird trying to help you with self-defense, but just kind of, you know, one of them is telling the story and the other person will be like, oh no, don't do that. Oh God, no, like we shouldn't get into this car with this guy. Or, but I also think that like the therapeutic element people get goes beyond that sort of dynamic that you and I were talking about earlier. And it just kind of leans into like the way the show is built. So in 2017, Andrea Marks wrote a piece for The Atlantic about Murderinos called How a True Crime Podcast Became a Mental Health Support Group. And she spoke to listeners who said that they felt empowered to begin therapy after listening to the show and listening to the women talk about their mental health. And other listeners, you know, shared their struggles with one another through these different Facebook groups. People who were lonely or moved to new cities and were trying to make friends were going to real life meetups for Murderinos and building community through there and kind of finding solidarity in that realm. I don't know, like, what do you make of that kind of dynamic?
It's like I just keep going back to this thought of, okay, maybe murder's always going to happen. If we're going to be living in this reality, like maybe we need things to kind of like soften the reality for us or kind of like comfort us in some way. So like maybe it's like a necessary evil to have a true crime podcast. I don't know if I agree with that idea, but that's just kind of maybe like an argument someone could pose. And then I keep being like, okay, maybe why don't these people just go to regular group therapy, or like why don't they just go to therapy in general? But then I'm like, okay, well maybe you need the cultural object to guide you into that territory. I don't know. Like, I don't know. Yeah. I don't, it's, I guess, a bit complicated.
Well, I think that, yeah, like a lot of them are saying is that this inspired them to go to therapy. And I mean, the show kind of blew up in the late 2010s, which I think is around the time where like openly talking about therapy and like maybe therapy culture was really starting to become a bit more mainstream. And so it sort of coincides with that. Again, it just kind of speaks to this being such like a fundamental aspect to someone's personality, which I guess if you talk to a sports fan, they might, you know, put that high up in like how they identify themselves. But it just feels a bit more sinister.
You're a fan of murder. Like, you know, it's just, it's kind of meta because the show is, they're not fans, but the way that the show has kind of positioned itself and like even titled itself, it's like, oh, our favorite murders, like we're fans of these cases that we can talk about and like dish about. And then by extension, then you're a fan of the show that's a fan of these murder, like, you know, these cases. And it's like, yeah, the thing you're a fan of is kind of the cases. Like you're excited about talking and dishing about these real life murders. And it's weird to make a fandom about that. Like, I don't know. I'm sure someone will get in the comments and be like, you're being close-minded, but I don't know. I think that there's a difference between being a sports fan and being a fan of a podcast that talks about real life violent murders.
Yeah, I think that while a lot of the time the podcast is sort of trying to make arguments against the sort of internalized shame we feel about our interest in true crime, I do think that sometimes shame is a good thing. I think we've become a bit too shame negative as a culture. I think North Americans are really shame negative. And I actually do think that...
You mean?
Oh.
Shame negative.
That's so North American of me. That phrasing is
that
so
was
fucking...
speak.
Yeah. Fuck.
That's so funny.
But I do think that like sometimes it's okay to feel bad or insecure about something, and sometimes it's okay to be like embarrassed to talk about something. And I think true crime is one of those things that like, look, we are all interested in it, but like that doesn't necessarily mean that we should like encourage like a further interest in it, or at least like
come out as a loud proud fan of the JonBenet Ramsey murder case. Like, huh? And like that's, it's been a joke that was kind of like the joke on Broad City, and it's like, that is funny. And people, you know, if I was at a dinner party and we're all kind of speculating, that's one thing, you know, it's in the privacy of our own homes. The families of the people aren't hearing about it, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not making money off of it.
And that's the other thing, is that it encourages the industry of true crime, right? My Favorite Murder, honestly, I think there is like worse kind of shows made in its image. At least it was the original. sort of this kind of two ladies talking about crime thing, but like a lot of shows have been made since that really center also around the consumption of alcohol, like Wine and Crime, Martinis and Murder. These are real shows. Like, I'm not making up these names. And it kind of, again, it goes into this sort of wine mom aesthetic where it just feels, it feels so weird.
I think even just like branching off again from the sheer like kind of weirdness of the true crime fandom.
Hey guys, we actually don't know if my mic had been unplugged, like just had lost connection the entire first part of this episode. So we're so sorry if that's the case, but if it is the case, I am back on the mic now. And huge apologies. I hope it doesn't sound like shite.
I think in addition to just like the weirdness of the true crime aspect, like the show has also sort of developed a weirdly like parasocial relationship between the hosts and the listeners. And it's sort of like we said, like given a lot of power to them as almost like self-help figures for their listeners. It's sort of like the people who would never like read Rachel Hollis or something, but like would want their own sort of millennial self-helpy kind of shit. Like
they're like, girl, wash your bong.
Like they're not like girl boss, go get it girl, but they have their own kind of feminist branded slogans. Their sign off is stay sexy and don't get murdered, which is also the name of their book, which you would think would maybe be about true crime, but is actually like a memoir that is also sort of like a bit of a self-help guide. Like they take turns writing about different subjects, but it's like a lot of it is their journeys with their mental health and addiction and like giving advice to their listeners. So there's like an acknowledgement there that a lot of their fan base is there for almost like the support and like the parasocial relationship beyond just the murder part.
Well, I just think there's a bit of like a having your cake and eating it too, also of being like, we're not experts, but then simultaneously providing like guidance to your followers. It's like, well, you're kind of still occupying a bit of an expertise seat. And I think having a podcast and having a microphone, like it comes with a lot of responsibility.
Well, exactly. And I think there's a lot of self-contradiction there that, again, you just, even with that, can go like, I know that we're sort of contradicting ourselves, but we're just two chicks recording our little podcast together, which we should start doing more often. Yeah.
Well, it's like we're not experts in any of the things we're talking about, but it's just trying to at least relay the information in a responsible way. And maybe sometimes we're not responsible about it, like, but it's the trying that counts.
I think if we were consciously trying to like really, really develop like some kind of like a parasocial community, I don't think we would get it like theirs. But I don't think we try to purport to be more to people than what we are. And I think obviously people, we have a lot of really nice interactions with like listeners and people can be really sweet, but like, I don't think we're trying to present ourselves as anyone's best friend. And I think that the community around this show, they kind of encourage this sort of discourse and also are very aware of like their listener base. Like in the book, they're kind of describing the types of girls that are probably reading it. And they're like, Karen writes, you know, I'm talking about the fuck ups and the drama queens and the ones who get told they're too much, too big, too loud, too smart, too mean. I'm talking about the people who've been severely scraped up by life and by the mistakes they've made in it. You guys are my favorite because you are me and I am you. It's like, Cool, we're all misfits, but like, again, like we've been scraped by life, but like we haven't been murdered. I don't know. Yeah. But then I think because people also have these bonds to them, the thing that happens to a lot of online public figures is that like politics also get brought into it. And going back to their like really popular Facebook group, there was this event that happened in 2018 that is known as the My Favorite Murder Dumpster Fire, which is when they had to close this official Facebook group because there had been like huge conflict between moderators and fans because one of their like unpaid volunteer moderators had approved a story that was racist. They do these hometown stories where people share like stories they have proximity to, and someone was saying how she was dating this guy and her mom was always really racist about him, and then he went and murdered someone later, and she ends the story with being like, I guess my mom was right. And yeah, understandably there was like immediate backlash to this story and the post, and someone took it down. And when members found out that the other moderators determined that the post being approved was a mistake and that they weren't going to kick out the moderator who they were keeping anonymous for letting it through, people were really, really angry. There's like long threads that I've read that someone posted on Reddit, like pages and pages of screenshots of people saying things along the line of like, I used to volunteer at a daycare for no money, and if a kid wandered off while I was watching them, I couldn't just say, oopsies, sorry, but also I'm not getting paid for this, so I guess I shouldn't have to take responsibility for my actions. And we're basically taking this very punitive approach to like unpaid moderators who were all like, hey, I have a family, I have a job, I do this in my spare time for fun. And people just kind of kept emphasizing the idea of this Facebook page being like this safe space and supposing to be like this community, but it's like 200,000 strangers congregating on Facebook, which 2018 Facebook is a very dark place to talk about murder. And I guess it's like the host had to then sort of go on and acknowledge what had happened, took down the Facebook page because they were like, we don't obviously approve of people sharing stories and talking like that on our behalf, on our page. But it's like the kind of idea of like having to sort of oversee and moderate community for this kind of a subject matter, again, is well, hard it's just to like, kind of wrap your head around.
That's interesting that this is your line. Like, you're like, this post was racist, and so this is really problematic, and not this entire community I'm a part of where we, like, dish as if we're just two girlies chatting about, like, other people getting fucking axe murdered. And I've always found that fascinating. One thing about true crime community, it is very punitive. True crime podcasts are famously extremely punitive, very retributive, very pro retributive justice, very pro prison industrial complex. Like, a lot of true crime media is like that, and so it would produce a fandom that is extremely punitive, but it's like the most lib thing on earth to be like, this is where I draw the line, and not like actually assess any of the other factors of the fandom you're participating in. Like, I don't know.
You know exactly. Yeah. One of the reasons I was like, okay, I actually can't listen to this show anymore is because at live shows, when they would talk about how like a murderer got the death penalty, the entire auditorium would erupt in cheers. And I'm like very against the death penalty for obvious reasons. And I just was like, it's like kind of sickening to like hear a bunch of people who paid $30 for this ticket to this show to be like, woo, we love
state-sanctioned death. Yeah. I love that. Yeah. I don't like death, but I do love state-sanctioned murder.
Yeah. I know.
My favorite murder is the like, state-sanctioned kind.
I love murder when my tax dollars pay for it. Like, really? This is one of the things that always made me uncomfortable with the show and with true crime media at large is like the way that they sort of try to incorporate feminism into the branding of the show and into like the whole shtick. Because a lot of the time on My Favorite Murder, if you criticize this stuff, they'll come back with like, well, as women, we're taught to like not talk about things that are dark or gross or uncomfortable in public, whether that's our mental health or murder. And since women get murdered, we're entitled to talk about it however we want. And it's like you can't be weirded out by it. Also, their mantra is like, fuck politeness. And with that, they're trying to be like, women, if things make you uncomfortable, you should fuck politeness, which is like at the same time, both victim blamey, but also I think encourages this idea that you should always be on edge because any stranger that talks to you is probably trying to murder you. But yeah, I guess I just want to end this off with like, do you think there's an ethical way to consume true crime, or should we even try and talk about it within the realm of ethics? Because like, should we just admit that it's just like a weird kind of animalistic like base thing that we like? Can we be feminist and like true crime? Like, does that even exist in the conversation?
I don't know. I think there are some pieces of media that maybe approach it from a more ethical way. Like, there's that famous show, The Investigation. I think it's either Danish or Swedish, but it's about the murder of Kim Wall, like the submarine murder. It's a really salacious, like really graphic murder, but the show doesn't say her name ever. It depicts her parents, but it doesn't depict her at all. Doesn't say the murderer's name, which I think is a good step in the right direction. Is just a procedural about the investigation behind it, because it's a really fascinating, like unprecedented investigation that is interesting for people who are interested in like law and criminology and stuff like that. And I think it approached things from a really good and interesting point of view. I watched that in really close succession to watching The Staircase, which is like a show about the like owl murder, where I don't want to even want to get into it, but it was a woman who got murdered very likely by her husband, but there was like a whole theory that an owl had killed her. It stars Colin Firth and Toni Collette. And I thought it was really well made, but there's a sequence at the end in the last episode where it goes through every single way that she could have been killed in the most graphic fucking detail you have ever seen. Like, it is so, so horrific, so traumatizing to watch. Like, there's one scene where he's just bashing her head into the stairs until it's into pulp. And you're like, this is a person. That's a woman who was murdered or killed, whatever, however she died. But it's like, watching those two in close succession, I was like, hey, there is a kind of like a better way and a less good way to approach things. I do think humans are always going to be inclined towards morbidity, and I think it's okay, and I don't think it should be. I think we should have shame about the type of content we consume. I don't think we should have shame about maybe being interested in morbid things, because there's so many psychological reasons as to why that is, and it's kind of just human nature. And so if we're going to have that inclination, at least we can try and find workarounds to how we're going to package that, I think. And I think true crime podcasts, for the most part, have done it the bad way.
They've encouraged not only the interest, but then the creation of more of those podcasts and more of that content.
Yeah, and I don't know if a podcast format can really approach things well. Never shut the fuck up about it, but you're wrong about when they do approach true crime in their episodes. It feels like as close to ethical as you can get, just in terms of like they come at it with statistics and an empathetic approach, and like they don't relish in the gory details at all. You know, there are some ways to do it. I don't think these girlies, I would say that because both of the people running, and this is not the case because Sarah Koenig's also a journalist, but like Sarah Marshall and Michael Hobbs are both journalists, maybe that helps, like these two random girlies just chatting about stuff that they don't have any knowledge about or like expertise in. Yeah, like you're not an expert, maybe you shouldn't be talking about this.
But we're not talking about us, of course.
No. Well, we're not experts either, but we're not also doing full episodes about true crime. Even then, though, it's like there are true crime podcasts that'll bring on like lawyers and prosecutors, and it's like, okay, but those people are also extremely prison happy, and it's like, so I don't know. Yeah, it's really difficult. It's really weedy. I just think it's difficult. Do I think that true crime should go away forever? No. But it is like, it's a little bit uncomfortable to think people are making money off of it when you really get down to the fact that like these are real people. They have families who are still alive, and someone's making money off of like the worst thing that has ever happened to you.
I wonder if it's a little bit like consuming animal products, where it's like shows like this or McDonald's and like having free range or like ethically sourced meat is like something that you can sometimes feel weird about, but you're like, hey, at least I'm doing it the best way.
My Beyond Meat True Crime podcast. Beyond True Crime. Mm-hmm.